Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. You know, of all the essential truths that underlie the day-to-day news stories we talk about on this show, this may be the most important one. We live in the most prosperous country, probably in the history of the world, but we have among the highest rates of poverty. And they haven't changed in decades, even as the number of billionaires has skyrocketed. And joining us now is perhaps the most important scholar of poverty in the U.S. today, Matthew Desmond, who's been exploring why that is and is out with a new book that actually proposes solutions to get us unstuck from perhaps the most shameful fact about the society we live in and that underlies, as I say, so much of our wrenching and polarizing politics. Some of you know sociologist Matthew Desmond from his Pulitzer Prize and National Book Critics Circle Award-winning 2016 book, Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City. It is said to have influenced the CDC's eviction moratorium as a central response to the pandemic. He is also a MacArthur Genius Grant winner. And heads up if you think this book is not about you. Yes, it's about the people in the economic basement, and yes, it's about those at the very top, who Bernie Sanders might call the 1%, but it's just as much about how Americans more in the middle, often without realizing it, contribute to keeping poor people poor and some things we can do to change that. Get ready for a new analysis and for proposed solutions. The book is simply called Poverty by America. And maybe you saw the New York Times essay adapted from the book this month called Why Poverty Persists in America. Matthew Desmond is a sociology professor at Princeton. Professor Desmond, welcome to WNYC.
It's great to be here, Brian. Thank you.
Can we start with your definition of poverty? How do you define poverty for the sake of your book?
Officially, poverty is an income level. You know, last year, if you had a family of four and you fell below $27,000 around there, you were officially poor. And there's 38 million of us in America that fit that bill. That's like the entire population of Australia. But poverty is not just a line. You know, it's this exhausting piling on of pain and agonies and humiliations. It's, you know, often chronic pain on top of the nauseating fear of eviction, on top of putting your hands in a public defender, on top of not giving your kids enough to eat. So it is this incredibly painful misery in America, and it means that millions of us are denied freedom and flourishing in this land of dollars.
You write that the late 1970s was the most economically equitable moment in modern history in this country. Can you start by describing conditions in the U.S. in the late 1970s?
Back then, one in three workers belonged to a union. Unions were powerful. They really flexed their muscles. CEO pay was reined in and worker pay climbed. Just one statistic, between 1945 and 1979, real wages, that's inflation-adjusted wages, increased by about 2% every year. So you had a job, you saw your pay going up, you had some benefits, you could advance in the company. But since 1979, real wages have increased only about 0.3% every year. Worker power has waned, CEO pay has skyrocketed. And for many workers without a college degree, they're getting paid less today in real terms than they would 40 years ago.
You mentioned non-unionized workers. You cite 1981, just after the late 70s, as a certain kind of turning point when the nation's unionized air traffic controllers went on strike at U.S. airports and President Ronald Reagan fired them all. They were federal workers, so he could do that. Reagan believed in trickle-down economics, so did that mass firing trickle down from one workforce to the broader economy?
It did not. You know, I quote a book called Radical Markets in my new book, and the authors write, you know, we were promised economic dynamism in exchange for inequality, and we got the inequality, but the dynamism has never showed up. We were actually a more productive economy when unions were strong than we were today. So not only have workers lost power, but the economy is much more sluggish than it used to be.
How do you, what would you say about that productivity? How do you measure, if you're going to make that claim, more productive workforce when there was more unionization?
Well, this gets a little wonky, but bear with me. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics just defines productivity as kind of the transfer of inputs to outputs. That is, you know, if you can make 5 birdhouses in 5 hours, if you can transfer that and make 5 birdhouses in 1 hour, you're more productive. So, you know, the country was much more productive when more of us were in unions, when more of us had collective bargaining power than it is today. And that actually matters for things like wage growth and just overall economic health.
But you also wrote that you used to assume that Reagan cut aid to the poor and that's why poverty increased, but you were wrong. Reagan didn't cut aid to the poor?
He cut some aid, but not all aid. So he gutted public housing. You know, he reduced HUD's budget by almost 70%, 70%. And we've just never recovered in terms of our investment in affordable housing. But other programs directed at the poorest families in America actually grew under Reagan's administration and continued to grow after it. So if you look at spending on our 13 biggest means-tested programs, things like Medicaid and food stamps, we went from about $1,000 a person the first year Reagan was elected to about $3,400 a person the first year Donald Trump was elected. That's a 237% increase. And so that makes our kind of stalled progress on poverty even more frustrating and baffling. And it's certainly not the case that, as some conservatives claim, that, well, this is evidence that, you know, government spending doesn't work. That's just completely false. But it is evidence that we need to do much more if we're going to end poverty in America.
Well, let's talk about ending poverty in America, because part of your book is solutions. But before we do that, I want to go through some basic demographics with you. Who's poor in the United States and what percentage of them are full-time workers?
Gosh, I don't have this data right here in front of me, but a lot of them are full-time workers. There was a study out of the Urban Institute that found that only 2% of poor folks were disconnected from the labor market for a reason we didn't really understand. The data couldn't tell us. And so this kind of picture of the welfare-dependent, non-working poor person is really a picture that isn't supported by data. And if you dig into the data, you learn that welfare avoidance, the fact that a lot of folks are leaving money on the table in terms of food stamps not claimed or earned income tax credit not claimed, then they, you know, in an incredibly high way. And so this isn't a picture of welfare dependence as much as a picture of welfare avoidance.
If you have these stats top of mind or at hand, how disparate are poverty rates by race and by gender?
So African Americans are roughly twice as likely to fall below the poverty line as white Americans. And black poverty and white poverty are not the same thing at all. And so one example is just the neighborhoods poor white and poor black families live in. Poor black families tend to live in neighborhoods of extreme concentrated poverty, where their neighbors are poor, their neighbors' neighbors are poor. But poor white Americans tend to live in much more economically diverse neighborhoods, which means their kids go to better resourced schools. Their housing is often more dignified. And so I think that's one way race and poverty collide. The gender ratios of poverty are fairly equitable, but we have seen kind of a decline of labor force participation among men without college degrees and an increase of labor force participation among women.
Listeners, my guest, if you're just joining us, is Princeton sociology professor Matthew Desmond. His new book is called Poverty by America. And listeners, why does poverty persist in this country more than other industrialized democracies? In your opinion, give us your theories or ask Matthew Desmond a question. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tell us your personal experience if you are poor or have ever been poor and want to talk about structural reasons for that. 212-433-WNYC or tweet at Brian Lehrer. All right, let's talk about what has worked to reduce poverty and some of the things that you propose as solutions for now. President Lyndon Johnson, as you reference in the book, had his so-called war on poverty policies in the mid-60s. And sure enough, you write that 10 years after those programs were started, there was only half the poverty that there was in 1960. That would seem like remarkable progress. What programs do you think made the biggest difference?
Probably Social Security, establishing Social Security in a major way. Also Medicaid and really kind of getting the country seriously invested in healthcare for low-income families. Making food stamps permanent, starting Head Start, also had major returns on investment. But remember, you know, the War on Poverty and the Great Society were launched during a time where the job market was really delivering as well. And that was kind of a 1-2 punch with poverty. And today, the job market is just not delivering for so many American workers. And so not only do we need to deepen our investments in anti-poverty spending, but we also need different investments. We need ways to stop exploitation in the labor market and the housing markets.
You cite the percentage of Americans in poverty over the years and how stubbornly consistent those percentages have been since 1970, 12.5% then, 10.5% just before the pandemic. But within that, as I'm looking at your numbers, there have been peaks and valleys. One that jumped out at me was that in 2010, the poverty rate in America was 15%. By 2019, it had dropped to 10.5%. That's like a third less poverty. Did happen in the 2010s that was really helpful?
Well, I mean, after 2010, of course, there was the economic recovery after the Great Recession. I mean, one of the things that's encouraging about the numbers you cite is the fact that we can make giant differences in ending poverty in the country. I mean, one of the best examples we've seen in recent years is during COVID, you know, with the extended child tax credit and rental assistance and unemployment insurance. We cut child poverty by almost half in 6 months, And the investment was pretty simple. You know, the child tax credit is just a wonky way of saying, you know, for middle income and lower income families, they just received a subsidy that said, look, you know, we recognize you're raising kids and we want to invest in that. That cut child poverty by 46% in 6 months. We have the resources and we know how to do this.
In 2020, you wrote a New York Times op-ed called How Trump's Race Baiting Lets Liberals Off the Hook. And as you know, of course, it was largely about towns in the New York City suburbs that voted heavily against Trump, but their housing policies contribute to keeping poor people poor, you assert. Where is that and how?
So a major cause of poverty in the United States is segregation. We continue to build walls around our communities, hoard opportunities behind those walls. And that concentration of affluence also creates a side effect, the concentration of poor neighborhoods. And, you know, liberals and conservatives both contribute to segregation. In fact, one study found that liberal homeowners were less likely to vote yes on an affordable housing project than conservative renters, which suggests that above a certain income level where maybe we're not so polarized after all, you know, maybe we're all segregationist above a certain income level. And I think the country has to confront that fact, and we need to tear down the walls and finally embrace broad prosperity.
Are we seeing that same debate play out now as Governor Kathy Hochul is trying to mandate denser housing development in Westchester and Long Island in particular, so there's less of an affordable housing shortage in the whole region, but local politicians are resisting a change to their notions of suburban life?
We're absolutely seeing that. And look, you know, there's really great research that shows that when affordable housing is built so it blends into the surrounding community, when it's well managed, it has no effect on property values. There's amazing research that shows that when our schools become more integrated, the children who were previously denied that opportunity do much better, and the children who are already in those schools don't get thrown off track. So this is a real opportunity for us to make sure our values don't stop where our property line begins.
Trey in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Princeton sociology professor and poverty scholar Matthew Desmond. Hi, Trey.
Hey, good morning, Brian. Great show. So many things they could do, Brian. They know what they could do. They just won't do it. They could give tax credits to renters. You know, why is it only for homeowners that pay mortgages? Renters pay rent all year. normally it's even more, especially in New York and California. It's more than 30% of your income. Sometimes it's 50, 60, 70% of your income. So why not give some of that money back? They could, but they won't. They could give tax credits to single people. Why are single people the most heavily taxed persons in America? Okay? Just because you're single means you're rich. It's single people working two and three jobs. Give them some money back. It's the list goes on and on, Brian. And they know what to do. They just don't care.
Thank you, Trey. Matthew Desmond.
I mean, Trey brings up this incredibly important point, the fact that we do a lot more in this country to subsidize affluence than to fight poverty. You know, he brought up the mortgage interest deduction. In 2020, we as a nation spent $193 billion, billion with a B, on homeowner subsidies. And most of that money went to families with six-figure incomes. And that year, we spent only $53 billion on direct housing assistance to the needy. How does that make sense that we give the most to families that have plenty already? I think we need to rebalance our safety net and make deeper investments in equal opportunity.
Another thing that you wrote that really jumped out at me about subsidizing the affluent rather than subsidizing the poor is what you write about banking. Because you point out that banks subsidize free checking, for example, and higher interest rates for the better-off depositors on the backs of lower-income depositors, just the opposite of what would be economic justice. How does that happen, for example?
So every year, banks collect between $11 and $12 billion in overdraft fees. You know, you can overdraw your account by $20 and end up paying $200 for it because banks can charge you fees multiple times during a day. Only 9% of clients are charged overdraft fees. So who are the unlucky 9%? Well, they're the poorest folks that bank. You know, they're folks that are holding really low balances. They are poor folks made to pay for their poverty. And who benefits from that? You know, surely the corporate banks do, but so do many of us who enjoy free checking accounts because they are subsidized by the poorest neighbors using the banks. And so it's an example of how, as James Baldwin said, it's incredibly expensive to be poor. And this is another way that the poor exploited.
Yeah. You know, after reading your stuff, maybe I was therefore hyper aware, but I walked by a bank just this weekend that was offering 3.5% interest on a money market account, but only if you deposit more than $10,000. Right. So there it is, right?
Right. I've had a lot of folks write in after they've read the book or the early essays and say, you know, when I was a student struggling to become a doctor, my health insurance was way more than it is now than I'm a doctor. I can afford to pay more, but don't have to. And a lot of American life works like that, which suggests that, you know, low-income folks aren't paying so much because it's riskier to lend them money or it's riskier to rent to them. They're paying so much because they often don't have another choice. They have to take the best bad option because it's the only one available often.
Danielle in Westchester, you're on WNYC with Matthew Desmond. Hi, Danielle.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one is around the dramatic cuts to housing that was mentioned under Reagan, the 70%. I was wondering if housing costs are not addressed since they're a substantial proportion of household expenses, can you actually, fix the long-term poverty issues that we have? It sounds like, you know, without changing the assistance given and making affordable housing more available to the majority of Americans, this is just going to be a persistent issue that you're going to have to provide patchwork for. And then the second question is, I wondered what the author feels about Heather McGee's work, The Sum of Us, and how it relates to his work around the causes of poverty and the persistence of poverty in America.
Thank you, Danielle. And anyone interested in hearing Heather McGee talk about her book, The Sum, S-U-M, of Us, she was just on the show recently for that book. You can go back to our archives. But Professor Desmond, Danielle's got two questions there.
So to her first question, she's right. You know, it's absolutely essential that we just recognize that without a stable, affordable home, everything else falls apart. And the book calls for deeper investments in affordable housing and a lot of different ones, right? You know, we can do this by building out our public housing infrastructure. We could do this by providing on-ramps to families into homeownership that they're often shut out from. There isn't a single right way to address housing, but there clearly is a single wrong way, which is the way we're doing it now, which forces most poor families who are renters to pay at least half of their income to housing costs and often experience eviction as a common feature of their life. The second question about Heather McGee's book, The Sum of Us, which I highly recommend, is a really interesting question. You know, Heather was approaching this question about how white and black communities during integration, how white communities often, you know, cut off their nose to spite their face in a way. They'd say, oh, we have to share our public pools with black families, but we'll fill up the pool. No one gets a pool. And I think there's some deep wisdom in there. I think my book is slightly different. You know, it asks many of us who are privileged, who are economically secure, who are well-housed and well-fed, to really consider how we do contribute to other folks' poverty in our investment decisions, our consumption choice, the way we protect our tax breaks, the way we guard our communities, and really try to take ownership of that and take a little less from the government. And so it is asking for us to really consider some skin in the game, but we don't just give. We're going to get something too, all of us. The elimination of poverty in this land is a safer, investment in a safer country, a happier country, a freer country, and a country without this kind of emotional violence that many of us feel by participating in this vast inequality.
For people who want to do what you just proposed, can we do it as individuals, or do we need to do it as citizens who are advocating public policies?
Yeah, I think both are really important, actually. You know, a lot of times we say, you know, the policies aren't the hard part. The public will is the hard part. Well, how do we build that? I think one way we build that is to change the way we shop, change the way we invest, change the way we talk about taxes. I think one way we can do that is by going to our Tuesday night zoning board meeting, right? And standing up and saying, look, I'm not going to be a segregationist. I refuse to deny other kids opportunities that my kids have had by living here. Let's build this thing. And so a lot of the tension between structural changes and individual changes, I think they actually collapse when you think about it. Obviously, we need big, bold policies, but we need to build a political will and put upward pressure on our corporate and political leaders to get there, too.
We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. Let me touch on some solutions to poverty that other people discuss that maybe you don't emphasize as much, and just get your quick takes. One is a more social democracy or democratic socialist approach, guaranteed annual incomes, like Andrew Yang ran for president on, as a monetary floor for Americans, or baby bonds, like Senator Cory Booker has proposed, so every American has money to build a middle-class life on, theoretically, when they reach 18, or a universal child care system, like in France, or other paid family leave policies from the social democracies in Scandinavia. What about that whole bucket of social democracy solutions?
I think there's some real wisdom in there. And one of the wisdom points is that we can afford to do this. A recent study showed that if the top 1% of Americans just paid the taxes they owed, we could raise an additional $175 billion a year. That's almost enough to pull everyone out of poverty. I think that we, along with these kind of deeper investments, though, in ending poverty, we also need to confront exploitation. Because if we don't confront exploitation in the labor market and the housing market and financial market, we do risk, you know, some of that money not ending up in the pockets of families.
And conservatives, as you know, raise a whole other group of things, especially family breakdown. An op-ed in the New York Post, for example, recently cited what we often hear from that point of view, referring to the strength of black families in America, black families in particular, but it, I think, applies to all families in America, they would say, before what they cite as white liberal Hollywood's free love culture normalizing sexual promiscuity. Now it says just 25% of black babies are born to married women, and the poverty rate in the black community is higher. So what do you say, basically the family breakdown theory?
Well, single parents in Ireland, in Italy, in Sweden, and many other countries are not disproportionately poorer than the general population. Why? It's because those countries have made deeper investments in their people, you know, especially through programs that benefit all citizens. And we could follow suit by investing in programs like affordable childcare or paid family leave. Wouldn't it be great if every family in this country, no matter its shape, you know, did not fall below a certain level?
And there we will leave it with Matthew Desmond, MacArthur Genius Award winner, Pulitzer Prize winner, and National Book Critics Circle Award winner for his last book, Evicted, now out with a new book called Poverty by America. Thank you so much for making everybody think.
Thanks, Brian.